Welcome to the Iron Basketball Podcast, the Pick and Troll Podcast. I'm your host, Zach Harper. No Matt Moore today. Instead, I've got a friend of the program, friend of mine, Tim Bontemps from the New York Post. How's it going?
Pretty good. Friend of the program is a step up.
Yeah, official. I believe it's your second time on. That's an official friend of the program.
That's good. I can add that to my resume.
I didn't know whether to call you that or to call you Bobo, because I know that's a nickname that you very much love. I saw that on Twitter this morning as you were watching, I believe it was Croatia, right?
Yeah, I was watching Croatia. You want to give the background on Bogdanović for people so they know who we're talking about?
Yeah, it's what's his first name? Bojan?
Bojan.
Bojan. Bojan Bogdanović is lovably referred to as Bobo by many, right?
I guess so.
The Nets have his draft rights. They haven't signed him yet, right?
Yeah. Then actually, this is funny because it relates back to the Wolves. The Nets got the first pick in the second round in 2011.
Right.
As part of the great let's pay off Kurt Rambis's salary.
Right.
Salary dump or draft pick dump by Minnesota.
No.
Draft pick rules.
I've got to correct you there. David Kahn swore on his children's lives that wasn't a salary dump. That had no financial repercussions, even though everyone could clearly see that it was obviously a move to pay for the departed Kurt Rambis.
Right. Well, and it's funny. That really should be called now the teams can only spend $3 million in the calendar year. It really should be called the Kahn rule or the Taylor rule.
Right.
You know, like the Stepien rule for the back-to-back first-round picks can't be traded after the Cavs owner in the 80s. That really should be what they call the $3 million rule, because they put it in right after that. But the Nets got him with the first pick of the second round, and then he's played in Turkey the last couple of years. And actually, he relates back to a guy we'll probably touch on later, Andrei Kirilenko, because Kirilenko only ended up on the Nets after Bogdanović. They couldn't come to an agreement with Bogdanović this summer on a contract. But yeah, some people I guess call him Bobo, and it's just a really awful nickname for any adult.
It's not a great one, I gotta be honest. It's not a great nickname to call a grown man. It's the same thing. I have a problem with Daniel Gibson being called Booby. It was like, he's in his 20s. He might be 30 by now. Yeah. I can't call a grown man Booby. I just can't.
Yeah, I agree with you on that, too. It's just an odd thing to call someone.
Yeah, I have a hard enough time when people call DeMarcus Cousins Boogie. Like, that, even that's a stretch for me. I get uncomfortable. Yeah. I just don't like nicknames in general. So, the Bobo, I'm with you. I will fight any Bobo supporter. I will fight them tooth and nail.
Well, Devin Preparation's all about it. So, you can take it on with him.
It's funny that how much David Kahn maybe helped influence the Nets getting Andrei Kirilenko with the whole Bogdanović, you know, falling out. It's Kahn had allegedly promised Kirilenko like a 3-year, $30 million deal. Like, these are just rumors. I can't tell you for sure that this was the case, but that if he opted out, he was going to get, you know, 3 years, $30 million. And then Kahn got fired, and Flip took over, and Flip was like, "No, I'm not doing that. Like, that's not our deal. Like, that was prior management. We have new management now." And
yeah,
ended up offering him the mid level for I think 2 or 3 years, and Kirilenko was insulted, and then he ends up on the Nets because they couldn't spend their mini mid level, right? They couldn't spend it on Bogdanović because they couldn't come to an agreement, and so. Yeah. By a couple of fortunate rolls of the dice there, Andrei Kirilenko is a Net now.
Yeah, I guess because of your ties with the Wolves, you probably should start with him, right?
Sure.
Just the whole Kirilenko thing.
Yeah, I would love to. Kind of shocked, like I didn't believe in the Nets' title chances before, because I just thought they don't really have anybody that can defend the wing there, and now they've got a really good wing defender.
Yeah, I mean, the whole. It is kind of remarkable how the whole Kirilenko thing came together. I mean, I frankly, you know, when it first happened, there was all kinds of scuttlebutt about, oh, there must be some nefarious work here, and, you know, the Nets Russian owner, Mikhail Prokhorov, must have given him, you know, a bunch of land in Siberia, or $10 million or something. But really, it's just the Mets just got really lucky. They initially wanted to sign Kyle Korver, who was clearly their top target for the mini-mid level, and then Korver wound up getting, I thought, kind of a, I mean, I think Kyle Korver is really good, but I mean, 4 years and $24 million from the Hawks for a guy who's 32.
Yeah, that sounds right.
And is really just a shooter. I mean, he's a good team defender, but I was surprised he got that much. But you know, so he is off the board, so he gets a way better offer than the Nets can go. And then it was like, okay, you know, Nets are, you know, I had reported that the Nets were, you know, expecting to sign Bogdanovich. I think Bogdanovich is expecting to come over, and then, you know, there were some complications with his buyout. So he had 1 year remaining on his deal with, you know, Fenerbahce's team in Istanbul, Turkey. And, you know, that ended up falling through. And that was tough for them because, you know, a lot of people don't really know much about Bogdanovich, but he's 24. He's a 6'8 guy. He can handle the ball a little bit. He can shoot. And he's a legit, you know, floor spacing three, which,
yeah.
Those people who watched the Nets last year saw with Jared Wallace for, I love Jared, all the things he brings. Shooting is really one of them. You know, so that was a priority for them going into the offseason, was they wanted to try to get some shooting on the wings. And, you know, here's this guy, a young guy that can sign for a couple of years. And then that falls through. And, you know, at that point, you're 10 days into free agency. There really aren't any guys out there. You know, the first name that kind of cropped up was that the Nets were going to sign Alan Anderson, who had a nice year for Toronto, but, you know, was certainly a step down from what they think the potential for Alec Bogdanovich is. You know, at the time I thought, well, maybe Kirilenko could maybe become an option, but, you know, that was that was around when the Spurs were, I think, trying to work the sign and trade for him. That never really works. I know Flip wasn't really interested in doing that,
right,
as I remember. And, you know, you just figure he was going to end up with, you know, multi-year deal for, you know, whatever. But, you know, they just basically said to him and said, you know, what about a year? And then he can go back out in the market next summer, and, you know, kind of worked out for all sides. Kirilenko's friends with Prokhorov, gets a chance to play the big market that he seems excited about, and play for the Nets, and, you know, play for a Russian owner, which, you know, he's made clear as a cool thing for him, and gets to play on a team that should, I would think, be in the top four in the East at minimum, and could, you know, could challenge for the Eastern Conference crown and beyond that. And, you know, then he gets to go right back out in the market next summer, assuming he has a healthy and productive year. So, you know, I think it was easy for people to assume nefarious things because of stereotypes and the way people kind of view the Nets and view Prokhorov, but it was really just a case of them getting, you know, lucky and, you know, having a couple things not break their way and then kind of having this fall in their lap. And like you said, it, the fact that they have a perimeter defender like him on the wings now is just such a huge upgrade from what they were looking at, that it's, you know, it's a pretty, pretty big thing for their chances.
And it wouldn't shock you if there was a block in his possession now in Moscow, right? Like,
that's the thing that the Nets, you know, because of the mystery factor around Prokhorov, you know, that's the kind of stuff that's just never gonna go away. And I think it's unfair, honestly. I mean, they've done everything by the book. You know, I mean, Prokhorov's willing to spend money, as he's proven, I'm sure we'll get into, but, you know, I think that the fact of the matter is those kind of jokes are here to stay, because that, you know, when you're in the situation the Nets are in, that's come with the territory, regardless of who's involved.
I think that there are those jokes that kind of just, like, you're always going to get the luxury tax jokes with the Bulls. You're always going to get the point guard jokes with the Wolves.
Sure.
You're going to get the slumlord jokes with the Clippers. Like, that is seem to be, like, you're always going to get the low-hanging fruit. I mean, you listen to the podcast. We're all about low-hanging fruit on here.
And I guess people hate that you talk about other things.
Right.
But we should talk about things also.
Right. Well, we're only going to do about 20 minutes on my viewing of War of the Worlds last night, and then we'll eventually get into the Nets.
I've been waiting for my review of War of the Worlds, so that's good. We can get right into it.
Yeah, it's really an awful movie. It's really bad.
It looked like one of the worst. It looked like a pretty awful movie.
And they don't. There's no ending. It's just, all right, we're done. Like, it's just they had no ending. It's unbelievable. And Tom Cruise doesn't run nearly enough in this movie, and he's a good runner.
I feel like Tom Cruise's only role in movies is to, like, wear aviator glasses, at some point rip them off, and for half the movie sprint away from stuff.
Yeah, he sprints away, and then like
that's what he does.
Yeah, and then like a quarter of the movie, it's just close-ups of him like looking really like worried, like something's about to happen.
And the other quarter is him looking really intense.
Yes.
Just staring black holes through people.
And that's all it takes for $20 million.
I guess so. Him being 5'4", or whatever he is.
Right. My dad told me the story. I can't remember why he was there, but he was at some like he was doing some tour of like a movie studio, and they had like a mannequin with clothes on it, and he found out that it was like it looked like a child, like the size of a child, and he found out it was actually Tom Cruise's wardrobe for some movie. Hell, it might even have been War of the Worlds, and he's just like blown away. Like anytime Tom Cruise comes up in conversation, he goes straight to that story. He only has about 6 stories that he tells anyway, but that's one of them. It's amazing.
That's a good one for the rotation, though.
Oh, yeah.
It's always a good conversation starter.
Yeah, it's a great one for the rotation. The other one of the other rotation stories is how Rhodesian Ridgebacks, the dogs were bred to hunt lions in Africa. So that's a little glimpse into what it's like to talk to my dad.
Clearly, Mr. Harper has range.
Oh, he's got a lot of range.
Which is good.
Yeah. Here's a segue. Speaking of range.
The range
on this payroll... there's been so much backlash against how much the Nets are willing to spend. And for Prokhorov, I mean, they're going to, what, be... It's got, like, $187 million when you factor in the luxury tax payments this year.
I think it's actually $189.
And to him, it's crazy, but, like, I guess he's earned this. Like, to him, that's not really that big of a deal. And you start getting into this competitive balance thing, and the luxury tax isn't good enough, and now maybe they're, you know, the league office is hinting at this could bring about a hard cap. And I just feel like if they're willing to make that kind of financial commitment, I'm not saying the Bobcats could do the same thing, but I just feel like
right at
a certain point they are hamstringing themselves by going this route. Now they've managed to do it in a good way to where you could make a case for them being a title contender this year because of the roster they've put together. Now, they can't really do anything outside of that to add to it if it doesn't really work, but I guess that's the risk they've run, right? And I don't know. I don't really see a problem with it in terms of competitive balance, because it's not like they went out and got the 8 best players in the world at $20 million a year.
Yeah, I can go on about this for about an hour and a half. I get really annoyed when fans or media people, or not really media people, but when fans especially criticize a team for spending too much money.
Right.
Like, to me, it should be the other way. Like, Clay Bennett moves the Sonics to Oklahoma City. Goes from a top 10 market to a top 50 market. And we know why he did that. And I'm friends with Royce. I'm not ripping on the Thunder, but when they then cry poverty in not being able to keep James Harden, and in my opinion, probably keeping them from ever winning a title with that group.
Right.
Because if you keep those 4 guys together, even if they don't win this year, I think they'd probably win one of the next 2, or maybe the next 2, or maybe they win each of the last 4. You could argue that series with Miami, those games are all 5-point games, they could have won that series.
Oh, absolutely.
So they let him go. And, you know, that is kind of hailed as, well, that's the new realities of the new CBA, and that's what they had to do. And my opinion is, okay, you can argue that. You can also argue that Clay Bennett is a extremely wealthy man who could have afforded to pay some luxury taxes. and move the team to this market. And, you know, if you wanted to win, you could have paid a little bit, and they would have won championships for sure. And they still could, but it's going to be a lot harder when you're replacing James Harden with Jeremy Lamb.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, for everyone who says, well, Jeremy Lamb's going to be, you know, sure, Jeremy Lamb will be good. Well, maybe he'll be good, or maybe he'll be like Cole Aldridge.
Right.
And then what do they have? So, to me, the people who mock Prokhorov for spending $190 million, like, okay, you can question the moves that they made. But to me, questioning a guy's willingness to spend that much money is, to me, silly. Because if you're a fan of a team, what do you want your team to do? You want your team to do whatever they can to win games. Well, whatever you want to say about the Nets, and people have said a lot of things, you can't question their willingness to win games and win now. Because they're spending, you know, I think the Knicks are the next highest payroll at $84 million.
Right.
Or $85 million. And that's just putting more in luxury taxes than that. So, they may not win a championship, but they are doing the things that they're doing everything that they can to have as good of a team as possible this season, which I think they deserve to be commended for. And I also think, frankly, the way the new rules were set up, obviously not the luxury tax paying, because that's a killer for them, but the limits on contract lengths and the shortening of everything that the league did to try to make bad mistakes that teams make in contracts less onerous over time, it actually, to me, really benefits the Nets, because all of this money is off the books by the summer of 2016. And there's a certain guy who is probably the second best player in the league who is a free agent that summer. And I think that, you know, Brooklyn could be a pretty attractive option to a guy as a free agent destination, given that they have an owner that's willing to spend whatever it takes to win. And they probably will still have guys like Darren Williams and some guys to still have on the team. You know, you can see that they have the potential to turn things over very quickly if they want. And, you know, the fact that they've shown the willingness to spend money, I think, has impressed players around the league. You know, I mean, I don't think that the Nets of 2 or 3 years ago would have convinced Kevin Garnett to waive his no-trade clause.
Right.
Or would have had Paul Pierce wanting to play there, or would have had Darren Williams re-sign there. So, you know, that's a really long-winded answer, but I guess the short answer is I don't understand why people get on a guy for spending money when I think every fan base would want their owner to spend whatever it took to win.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I mean, it's at a certain point, like, it's not your money, so I guess I always kind of feel like it's not my money, so I don't really care.
It's never the fans' money. Like, the fans who worry about, you can worry about the luxury tax and that, well, I don't know if my owner, like the Bulls, I don't know if my owner, Reinsdorf, say, or Clay Bennett, or whoever, I don't know if they'll pay the luxury tax to keep a guy. But I don't think I would be worrying for a billionaire's money. Like, oh, no, they might have to pay the luxury tax. Like, well, okay, who cares if they have to pay the luxury tax? Like, that's not my money or your money or, you know, Joe Schmo's money in Section 320 at some arena.
Right.
You know what? Who cares if they have to spend this money?
Yeah.
But you did reference the league office. I interviewed Adam Silver last month, and I asked him about the Nets, and his first thing was, well, as a proponent of a hard cap, and he kind of went into an answer. You know, and I, with him becoming the new commissioner, I don't think that they anticipated anybody doing what the Nets have done.
Right.
The luxury tax penalties are so severe, and the repeater tax is so severe that I don't think they expected anybody to be willing to spend under $90 million in a season. And we'll be very curious to see if in the new agreement, whenever it happens in 3 years or 5 years or whatever, if they do push harder for a hard cap because there is at least one team, maybe, you know, maybe the Lakers, maybe the Knicks, maybe one or two others might be willing to even go beyond what they expected. I'd be very curious to see how that plays out.
Yeah, well, the thing that kind of bothers me about this possibly being something that drives a hard cap is, one, I'm against a hard cap. Like, I just think it's a bad system for the NBA to implement. And I would be very disappointed if that happened. And two, like, to me, it just seems like this is not going to be a great example, but the lottery used to be unweighted, and that's how I believe it should be. And then Orlando won the number one pick in the lottery in back-to-back years. And everyone freaked out and like, well, this can't happen. This is unfair. And it's like, it's an anomaly. Like, you're not, you might get the Knicks and you might get the Lakers and you might get the Nets spending the kind of money the Nets are spending in a season at certain points throughout the CBA. But I don't think that just because a team is spending a lot of money, does it, like you kind of alluded to earlier, like, it doesn't mean they're spending the money wisely necessarily. And
look at the Knicks of the whole 2000s.
Exactly. Right? Like, you can spend money and it doesn't give you an advantage necessarily. It just, it maybe gives you more options at a certain point. But even then, now, like, the options have become so restricted that you really only have, like, the Nets really only had this kind of 1 year, maybe 2 year window to spend this kind of money. Like, they weren't just going to be able to add salary like that or keep adding salary to what they have. And so, you know, they're kind of swinging for the fences, maybe just trying to be as great as possible to get their, you know, their Q rating up and get the spotlight on them even more as they fight for, like, ownership of New York. And then, you know, 2016 comes around and maybe Kevin Durant is like, well, look, they're willing to spend money. They've been incredibly competitive. Yeah, maybe I will go there. And I just, right. like, I don't think, I just think it's a weird, I think it's a bad reaction to have of saying, see, this team is spending all this money. Now we've got to fix this. We've got to bring in a hard cap. Like, I think it's overreactionary.
No, I agree. It's completely overreactionary. And if you look at it, and the other thing I think that really isn't mentioned much is if you look at what the new CBA did, it really penalized the teams that do spend money because you can't do sign and trades. You can't sign guys. You can sign one free agent for more than the minimum salary.
Right.
That's for the mini mid-level exception, which is lower than the regular mid-level exception. So there's all these things that are in place. Like, for instance, if the old rules were in place, how big of a factor would Brooklyn be for LeBron in 12 months? I think you can make an argument they'd be the favorites for LeBron
yeah.
in 12 months.
Yeah.
If you could do sign and trades and if the old rules were in place, because they have everything LeBron wants in terms of cachet and the Jay-Z connection, even though he's now sold his share of the team, but he's still around it. And, you know, they're in New York and they're a hip new team and you get to a big market and all the possibilities that come with that. And they have an owner that's shown they'll spend literally whatever it takes. And, you know, like all you could see that. You can see why it would be appealing to him. While under the new rules, they have no chance of signing him because they'd have to trade away $75 million in salaries, which is obviously not going to happen. And the other thing is, the only reason they were able to make the trade they did was because they, A, signed Chris Humphries the summer before to a two-year contract for $12 million a year, which at the time people justifiably thought was too much, but the reason they did it was because they looked ahead and they saw, look, in a year, this is going to be our only trade chip.
Right.
And we're going to have this one big expiring contract to go get a guy because we're going to be way over the cap and we're not going to be able to do signing trades and we're not going to be able to make any creative signings, so we're going to have this. So they do that, and then they're able to also package it with Gerald Wallace's contract, which most people didn't think to be able to trade, and they got Paul Pierce and Kevin Garnett. Jason Terry.
Well, and also this.
They had
I mean,
to jump through a lot of hoops to make this happen. It wasn't like it just fell in their lap.
Right, and kind of like how the Kirilenko thing just kind of, you know, randomly happened because of a series of events. If the Celtics don't trade Doc Rivers, the Nets don't get Paul Pierce and Kevin Garnett this summer, right? Like, there's no way they break. Like,
right.
If Doc Rivers comes back and says, "I'm committing to the team," Right. They don't have
Paul
that
Pierce
chance
doesn't
of
go
making that trade.
anywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Like,
Paul Pierce and Kevin Garnett are probably there.
so
Right.
it's not like they could just go out and force teams into these trades. Like, they saw a situation, they took advantage of it, and they were savvy about it. Now, I didn't believe that it was going to lead to anything more than maybe the Eastern Conference Finals and then getting destroyed by Miami before they got Kirilenko, but then they kind of were fortunate enough to have Kirilenko be available to them at a very, very cheap
Right.
price. And
Right.
I don't fault teams for taking advantage of missteps from other teams throughout the league. Like, I think that's the competitive nature of building a roster, right? Like, you have to look at the lay of the land, and you can kind of see, all right, this team has made this decision. I think we can pilfer that guy from them. I mean, it's just that
Sure.
stuff happens, and if you're savvy about it, I don't think it's necessarily about a money thing. I think it's about, like, being a good vulture in a way.
Well, what's the difference really between the Nets getting Kirilenko at the price they did and the Heat getting Shane Battier to sign for under market value,
Yeah,
and
exactly.
getting Ray Allen to sign for under market value? And good teams attract guys to them. So and they also take advantage, like you said, they take advantage of both opportunities that present themselves and missteps by other teams. And I think that's where Billy King deserves a lot of credit. And I know he is not universally hailed as a good general manager. I think he's done a very good job with the Nets. I think if you go back to when Dwight Howard was on the table, thankfully he's not anymore. You go back to March 14th, the night of March 14th of 2012, I guess it was, last March. If Dwight gets traded to the Nets that day, Billy King would have traded for Deron Williams, traded for Dwight Howard, not really given up a whole lot for either one other than Derek Favors and some picks. I mean, I think Derek Favors is a good player, but you'd rather have both of those guys than
Right.
Derek Favors.
Right.
And he would have cap flexibility. He would be hailed as a genius. So, okay, Dwight turns into a crazy person in terms of decision making, as you proved over the last year and a half, and opts in for reasons still no one can understand. So then he turns to plan B. He gets Joe Johnson, he gets Jerald Wallace, he convinces Deron to come back, which I think was something a lot of people didn't think he'd be able to do. And that's had a pretty good season last year, all things considered. And then you look at what he's done this summer, and the Nets go from 2 years ago coming to Brooklyn with literally an empty roster. I think the only guy they had Marcelo Brooks signed, and I think they had one other guy, I think, signed. They had one or two guys under contract on July 1st of 2012, and now they have a team that, I think Miami, pretty much everyone would say, is still the favorite to, and deservedly so, to get out of the East, but. I think whether it's the Nets are right there with the Pacers and the Bulls,
Right.
and I think have a shot to beat Miami, which 15 months ago, if you'd have told me that the Nets were going to have a chance to beat, legitimately go toe to toe with the Heat in the playoff series, I would have been pretty skeptical. So I think, and it's easy to say, well, sure, the Nets have more money than anybody in the league, and they have an owner who's willing to spend whatever it takes. But you also have to make, like you said, you can certainly make the wrong moves and end up with teams like the Knicks did in the 2000s, where they didn't win a playoff game despite having paying luxury taxes 8 of the 10 years, probably. So you do still have to make good moves, and I think that if you look over the course of the last 2 years, I think he's made many more good moves than bad.
Yeah, I mean, I've certainly been very critical of Billy King in the past,
Right.
and I still, honestly, I mean, I'm not sold on him as a decision maker. I think having such a big checkbook at his disposal has certainly helped him kind of avoid his typical mistakes. But at the same time, like, you still do have to make the, I mean, making the trade, like, moving Jarrell Wallace and Chris Humphreys, and then, all the supplementary players in between for KG, Paul Pierce, and whatever is left of Jason Terry is a very savvy move. Getting Kirilenko to sign is a very savvy move. I mean, they've built this roster in a way of, I mean, taking a chance on Andre Blatch and having him decide to be offended that the Wizards would rightfully amnesty him. Like, you know, like you take chances like that, and it looks like they're paying off. So while he hasn't had a great track run, a great run over his career, at least the last like year and a half, you can say, all right, maybe I don't think that it'll lead to a championship, but you can see the reasons for all of these moves being made, and I think that he is at least outperforming what his reputation has been, for sure. I mean, and by a wide margin, at least right now.
Right, right. Well, I think he was pretty open about the fact that he learned a lot from his Philly experience, and he was a really open GM when he took over. And,
yeah.
You know, they got in kind of a weird situation where they're trying to spend to keep that team built around Allen Iverson, and, you know, they obviously made some mistakes in free agency, and he was pretty open about the fact that he didn't. You know, he was cognizant of that. You could see with during the whole Dwight thing, they didn't go out and really sign any guys. They didn't sign in May. They, you know, they signed Humphries to a 1-year deal. They did all these things to make sure they were well positioned, and then, you know, did everything right, and it still didn't work out, which happens sometimes.
Yeah.
But they were able to pivot and still go into Brooklyn with a very competitive team, and now they go into their second year with an even better team. And, you know, I think that, you know, that's funny as a whole, in that they kind of have this whole sorry about my cold. They have kind of an epic level of the organization, guys that people are happy to poke fun at, whether it's, you know, the ownership or the GM, or, you know, their hiring of Jason Kidd, or you know, Darren Williams as their point guard. You know, people have found things to criticize about all those guys. And I'm curious to see how it all comes together this year, because they have a chance to, you know, kind of quiet all those different criticisms all at the same time, which, you know, is certainly not something that you see in a lot of places.
In positioning themselves the way they have, they've also positioned themselves from a marketing standpoint, from a talent standpoint, to compete with the Knicks for New York. And while it may be an uphill battle, do you think the Nets are prepared to deal with J.R. Smith unfiltered while he's injured and suspended? Because this war of the words, I mean, J.R. took it up a notch.
I don't know if anyone's prepared for unfiltered J.R. Smith.
The only thing that could really save them in this war of the words is if Jason Terry comes back to life, because Jason Terry was quite the trash talker in his day.
Yeah, I think Jason's going to actually be good for the Nets, because he's never been, and you've seen enough of him play, he's never been a point guard. And in Boston, he was kind of the de facto backup point guard, and he was kind of the de facto point guard when Rondo got hurt, and that just isn't. It's never been a role he's been comfortable with.
Right.
And he's going to be a spot-up shooter off the ball who can create a little bit in Brooklyn, which is way more suited to both what he's good at now and what he's always been good at. So I think he's going to actually be okay. And, you know, I know Matt always gets on the Nets about their marketing stuff, including on the podcast. And you can certainly, they've certainly been aggressive, I'll say that, in their marketing of everything. But I don't know if people quite understand what they locked into in Brooklyn. The last year in New Jersey, I believe the Nets were 31st in merchandise sales among NBA franchises. Now you might go, well, wait a minute, there's only 30 teams. How is that possible? Sonic's gear actually sold more than Nets gear the last year in New Jersey.
Oh my God.
Now you can factor that into, well, the Nets are moving to Brooklyn and the team is terrible a couple of years and all that, but still, they were below the basement. At the end of this last year, they were fourth.
Yeah.
I think it was, I want to say it was the Heat, Lakers, and Bulls, or I don't know, some combination of those three teams and the Knicks. I think it was three of those four teams. And then the Nets were fourth. might have been Nick Seat Lakers, whatever it was. It's pretty remarkable that regardless of what happened, whether they had a move or anything else, that a team could go from 31st to 4th in a 12-month period. So, you know, that I think is pretty indicative of the work that they've done to get their franchise out there. And I think the league as a whole has been pretty stunned at how immediately they have latched on, both in the city and nationally. And I go everywhere and I see Mets stuff. Every game I was at this year, I saw Mets stuff. And not even just in the arena, like in the streets in cities. And, you know, maybe there were fans that flew into town for the game, but still, I covered the team the year before, and I didn't, you know, there were Nets games in Newark against the Knicks where there were, you know, 16,000 Knicks fans and 1,000 Nets fans
right.
in the arena. So when it was 50-50 or 60-40 for Nets games in Brooklyn against the Knicks, well, that's a pretty big jump in a year. You know, the Knicks are always, I think, it is a really uphill climb because people outside of New York don't quite realize that the Knicks are the number one team here, even more than the Yankees, because the Yankees have always had the Mets or the Dodgers or the Giants. Like, they've always had other competition for fans here, but the Knicks, for basically their entire history, there was no other team in New York. So basically anybody that grew up in the city itself was a Knicks fan. And you know, it's going to take time for that to change, but, you know, I think, if nothing else, they've certainly become a legitimate alternative, which, you know, as somebody who's been around here for a while, 15 months ago or 2 years ago, I mean, if anybody had said the Nets could become a legitimate alternative to the Knicks, you'd have been laughed out of every room you were in.
Right.
And even when they had Jason Kidd in one of the finals, they were an afterthought. I mean, you know, if they had a team like that here now, they would be probably the most popular team in the city, which, you know, certainly is just unthinkable then.
Really, the only marketing mistake they made was the Brooklyn Knight. There's no way they can hold on to this long term, right? Like, at a certain point, you've got to amnesty this idea and just realize you've made a mistake.
I'm telling you, take a picture of it once again, doing something silly. I'll never forget the first. There were two amazing things about the Brooklyn Knight at the start. They handed out these comic books. Cause last year, the Nets were supposed to play the Knicks opening night before Hurricane Sandy. And they obviously got postponed. But they had these, like, you know, souvenir comic books for the debut of the Brooklyn Knights. There was actually, I don't know if you know this, Marvel actually designed the thing.
No.
So they did this whole, they got Marvel to design this comic, or design this mascot, and then they did this comic book to go with it. Like this, oh, here's the Brooklyn Knight, whatever, you know. As they're, you go through the comic book, there's a scene of like the players in the locker room before the game, and I think it's Darren Williams on one side and Gerald Wallace on the other, and Amari in the middle. So Amari in the next, in the next locker room before the game.
Okay.
It was just a hilarious mistake. And then they had the Brooklyn Knight come down from the ceiling, and so the first game last year, whatever the first, I think it was against Toronto. The rescheduled opening game. Like, they have the Brooklyn Knight come down from the ceiling, and he's supposed to, like float down on this tether and then get unhooked and run around, and couldn't get unhooked. But that was really just the sign of all the mistakes to come for the Brooklyn Knight.
Oh, my God.
It's not really... If you're gonna make the Brooklyn Knight, then... You know, maybe you just change the team to the Brooklyn Knights, and then, you know, all right, that makes some sense. But I don't know. It's been a hard sell for people. I think, like you said, of all the marketing decisions they made, I think that's the one that you could probably question the most and say, I don't really know where you guys were going with this.
Yeah, because even when they came out with like the jersey concept and the colorways and all that, like, people were like, oh, it's too basic, it's too boring. I was like, no, that's brilliant, because.
Mm-hmm.
Why does Raiders gear sell? It's not because the
right.
Raiders have ever, like, I mean, they were good, you know, 30 years ago, and they were good about 10 years ago, but, like, they suck, and they've sucked for a while, and they're a bit of a joke, but people like the colorway. They like black and white. It's why White Sox stuff did so well. Like,
you can wear You can wear black and white with anything.
Exactly. Like, that's just,
genius.
That is a brilliant marketing ploy. And from that, from the way they've attacked, like, kind of the, like, me personally, obviously, I'm far away from the city, so I think, like, the whole, like, battle for New York thing, I'm just like, wouldn't you want to battle for the Eastern Conference title more than ownership of New York?
Well,
but,
yes.
But, like, I get the whole,
I
like,
feel that way too.
I get the whole, like, you know, pissing contest involved with it, but the way they've gone about it at least has been entertaining, and it's, I don't know, it's been pretty smart.
I think so too, and I'm gonna have to write a lot about the battle for New York, and I'm already pretty tired of it. I think for the most part that the guys are gonna focus more on the bigger picture. But you know, I think for the Nets, you know, last year they didn't finish ahead of the Knicks in the Atlantic Division, and they didn't get out of the first round of the playoffs. The Knicks won the division, they got to the second round. So I think the reason you're seeing guys like Paul Pierce say things like that is, you know, you want the expectation to be, you come in and win your division, that gets you a top three or four seed, that gets you home court in the first round, then you can step forward to where you want to go from there.
Right.
If you don't win your division, and that's worth 4th last year, but most likely you're going to be a lower seed. You're going to be on the road. Like Celtics, they won what? 6th division title, 5 division titles in a row with that group there. And I think that's going to become the focus. But Pierce has always loved to tweak the Knicks. And,
yes, very much so.
I don't think he's mind that. And you know, obviously Jason Terry's never been a guy to be quiet, and you know, JR is a complete lunatic. So, you know, all the elements are there. You know, and now the Nets are playing the Knicks in the preseason, which is interesting. I haven't gone back and actually looked officially, but I can't remember the last time they didn't play in the preseason. They're playing Miami twice. They're not playing the Knicks, which is odd. So it's going to be interesting, but I'm also going to be writing about it a lot more than I would prefer to.
What are the odds you get out of the locker room after each game in under an hour and a half? Because I mean, you got to
pretty slim.
Yeah, you got to get there quickly, right? Because Kirilenko ducks out early. And then, you know...
Oh, it's good to know. I didn't know that.
Oh,
Brooke,
yeah.
Brooke is very quick.
Yeah, Kirilenko Brooke's very quick.
But then last year, they had kind of a... There was kind of a progression. You go from Brooke to Joe Johnson to... You know, the other guys were all kind of ready after Brooke. And then Gerald and Darren would take a while, but not that long.
Yeah.
They certainly don't take as long as KG.
No, I don't know. Maybe Kobe takes longer than KG, but
from my experience, he's the longest in the league.
Yeah.
KG. Even longer than Melo, who takes a very long time. But KG, I think, KG is the best of all time at a lot of things. He's probably the best of all time at that.
He is. He's really good at waiting out the media. Someone who isn't there yet, but might be someday, Ricky Rubio. He loves to wait it out. Oh my God. He tries to stretch as long as he can.
But you will never wait. You'll never wait long enough to see his little puppy dog face in the Wolves locker room, I know. So
yeah.
He'll at least have to talk to you every day.
Yeah, oh yeah. I'll wait it out. I'll set up a tent in there. I'm fine.
I've got my campfire ready to go.
Yeah,
whenever you're ready, Ricky.
I'll set up a little like a little inflatable pool. Throw some fish in there. Peck and I can fish while we wait for Ricky to come out and talk. It's a great time.
We'll go on a complete tangent for a minute. How is I haven't gotten to see enough of EuroBasket because I've been on vacation and stuff. How is Ricky doing in EuroBasket?
He's actually been pretty good. It's weird because they just don't use him a lot. Like it's a lot of like. Dribble up, pass off, go to the corner. Like he gets to run pick and roll a little bit, but it's just like And Wolves fans are mad about it. They're like, they don't use him properly. This is ridiculous. I'm like, I don't know. He's out there playing for his country, but he's not killing himself by like, right, you know, really going hard against it because they don't use him that well. Like, I'm cool with it.
It's a totally different style of play, which a lot of people here don't really realize. Like, there's the pick and roll's not really utilized.
Exactly. And
ball's a lot different.
Yeah, and it's unlikely he's going to get injured, you know, just standing in the corner, which that's true. Like, I want him to represent his country. I want them to do well so that, you know, it seems like he didn't waste his time or anything, and I want him to not get injured. Like, that's the thing. But his 2-point jumper, like, off the dribble looks good right now. I think he's shooting around 50% for the tournament. His 3-point shot's still just atrocious. Like, it's just, the mechanics are so weird and so bad. Yeah.
That's really the thing he's got to. I mean, I've loved Rubio forever. And as a basketball fan, when there were all those talks about the Knicks trying to get him with Antonio, I was like, oh God, I hope he's in New York. It would just be great. Be a great stage for him. And playing for a guy like Antonio would be a perfect system for him. Yeah. And you know, I was always hopeful that would work out. But, you know, he does so many things well. If he can become a solid, like, the guy, he's not really, it's back to the Nets a little bit, but, you know, he reminds me of Kidd in that if he can just get to be a solid 3-point shooter, Kidd became a pretty good 3-point shooter, but, you know, if he can develop the way Kidd's shot did and just get to be where he's a respectable threat, he's going to be so good, because then you'll have to get up on him, and it'll just be so dangerous if that happens. And I think that'll happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's got a good chance. Like, it's weird, like, trying to fix a shot, because you can alter your mechanics so much in practice, but then you get into a game and you have the best athletes in the world flying at you to try to stop the shot,
and
your muscle memory from, you know, the previous 20 years as opposed to the last 6 months kicks in.
Right.
And so, you know, you do see differences in his jumper in the pregame warmups and in the pregame workouts, but then, you know, game time comes and it's just there's not really that much difference than it used to be, which is frustrating. I'm actually not that worried about the jumper, because I think that's easier to fix than him learning how to finish at the rim, because he's just so off balance, and I don't know if it's a strength thing. Like, he's put on some muscle, so maybe it'll just be easier for him than it was by having more strength, but. For a guy who's as good at judging the floor with passing, driving, and he's so good with footwork, once he gets around the basket, he's so off balance because his footwork is so weird around the basket that he's just not a good finisher, and he takes a lot of bad attempts. So I think if he can fix that before the jumper, I think that'll do a lot for his game.
What do you know, Ed? I don't mean to put you on the spot. Do you know what he shot at the rim last year?
Oh, it's in the 40s. Like, if, I want to say, like,
oh, wow.
Yeah, it's like 48% or something. It's bad.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, you'd think he'd have to probably get up another 10%.
Yeah, probably. But, I mean, I think league average was like 56 or 57. I think he needs to be around league average.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it was that low.
Yeah, it was. I think his first year it was like 44%. I mean, he's been below 50% both years.
Oh, okay. Didn't know that.
Yeah.
I'm curious how that changes.
Speaking of Jason Kidd, what do you think of the hiring?
It certainly surprised me. I also don't think it's going to be. I think it's going to work out fine, at least in the short term. The thing my interactions with Kidd so far, the thing that's impressed me about him is he hasn't walked in and acted like somebody who has all the answers, which I think is a good thing.
Yeah.
A lot of guys in his position, you could see them walking in and wanting to overcompensate and say, yep, I know exactly what I want to do. This is what I'm going to run. This is how we're going to practice. This is how we're going to play. I've got everything figured out. And he's walked in and said, I have a lot of things to learn. You know, I have ideas of what I want to do, but I'm going to hire a good staff and I'm going to lean on them. And he's actually, you know, and speaking to me directly, he's brought up what Larry Bird did with the Pacers, which was, you know, Rick Carlisle is obviously not a head coach now. running his offense, and he had, you know, another very well-known legendary assistant, Dick Carter, running his defense. And Larry kind of oversaw and poked his head in where he thought he needed to and handled personalities and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I think the Nets have done basically exactly that. They hired a very respected assistant, John Walsh, from Denver, who's under George Karl, to run, to kind of be their offensive coordinator. And they've, you know, as everybody knows, they brought in Lawrence Frank, and he's going to be, you know, kind of in charge of their defense. And then they're going to have Jason kind of overseeing. And I think if you go down through Jason Kidd's career, he's always had a tremendous impact on guys on his team.
Yeah.
Whether it's even last year with guys like J.R. Smith and Carmelo Anthony, and you go back to in Dallas with Turk, and you know, when he got out there with Jason Terry, and obviously with his time with the Nets and everything else. So, you know, he's proven that to be a strength of his. And I think with that formula and with the fact that they already have such a veteran team anyway, it isn't really going to need, they don't need a guy to mold a lot of these players. I think it's got the potential to be very interesting and be very successful. Now we'll see if, late game situation stuff, how that goes. And I know people are going to be quick to criticize him. I mean, frankly, the whole cell phone thing at the Summer League was maybe the dumbest controversy of all time. I mean, people are still getting on him about that. He, A, wasn't coaching the game.
Right.
And B, people were like, oh, he was sitting on the bench. He wasn't sitting on the bench. He was sitting at the scores table, and somebody called him, and he went and answered the phone. Like, it wasn't like he was coaching the Summer League game, had the clipboard in his hand, said, oh, crap, guys, I got to take this call. It's a moving guy, and left. I mean, not to emphasize this anymore, it was a Summer League game.
Right.
It literally doesn't matter.
I expect half the players to answer a cell phone if it rings during Summer League. I mean, it's Summer League. Who cares?
Yes. Right. For people who, and you've obviously been to Summer League. I've been to Summer League.
Yeah.
It is the most casual
atmosphere
of all time. Most of the time, if there's 500 people in the gym, they're the people on the benches and the players, and about four people in the stands paying attention to the game.
Yeah.
And everyone else is either saying, why am I here? Or they're focusing on entirely different things and talking about other things, and it really doesn't matter. So for people to be going, well, Jason Kidd is clearly not focused enough on his job, so he took a phone call in the middle of the Summer League game that he wasn't coaching or on the bench for, as soon as I saw that happen, I was like, here we go.
Well, and like, what do you?
Where's it gonna start?
That's the thing, though. Like, where does it go? Like, do people honestly think that, like, it's Knicks Nets in the first round, and it's Game 7, and they've got 20 seconds left, and Kidd gets a phone call. He's like, oh, sorry guys, I gotta take this here.
Yeah,
Lawrence,
yeah.
Why don't you take over? Like, that's never gonna happen in an NBA game.
It was. And like I said, as soon as I saw him get up, I was like, all right, I'm giving it 20 minutes, and this is going to be on Deadspin or Basketball Talk or CBS or some blog. He's going to have this up, and it's going to become a thing. And I was like, I'm not asking a question about it.
Right.
I'm not writing about it. It's the dumbest thing of all time. And sure enough, it turned into a huge internet controversy. How dare Jason Kidd leave a Summer League game? What half the other team's coaches weren't even there.
Right.
Which is fine. Means literally nothing.
They're like four guys on that roster that are gonna have a chance to make the team. Like, it's not that serious.
Yeah, the Nets had their three young guys on the team who are on the team now, Togo Shingun, Tyshawn Taylor, and Mason Plumlee, the first round pick.
Right.
And the rest of the guys literally had no chance of being even in training camp, basically. So it's just, you know, it could have mattered less. So starting on a rant, but that whole thing just really, really drove me up a wall this summer. So it was just such silly noise about nothing.
All right, well, do we have anything else to talk about? I feel like this might be a good stopping point. Did you have anything?
You haven't really Well, we have to get to Paul George and Roy Hibbert.
Oh, yeah.
We haven't, but we also, you haven't really, I'm surprised you haven't really pinned me down on what they're going to do. Like, I thought you'd do the radio host thing of, well, how good are the Nets going to be? Thoughts.
I need a win prediction right now from you.
I think that the thing about the Nets is, I think that if everything, if it's a disastrous season, I think the baseline is what they did last year.
Yeah.
Which is 49 wins.
Yeah.
Because they didn't get, that's if things go terribly wrong. So I think they'll probably win in the low to mid 50s. They could win more than that because, as you and Matt have talked about extensively in your summer recast, which have been very good.
Thank you.
For all the teams. There's so many awful teams in the East.
There are.
you can go down the Eastern Conference and, I think the top four are pretty clear with the Heat, the Nets, the Pacers, and the Bulls. The last three in some order. I think the Knicks are probably fifth. And then you've got, the next group of, and that might be the end of the above 500 teams. And then you have.
Oh, I'm big on the Hawks.
I think the Hawks would probably be okay, but you've got the Wizards, the Hawks, the Cavs, the Celtics. The Bucks, those teams are all, they could be okay.
Raptors.
They're not going to be great.
Yeah.
The Raptors. And then you have just, the Sixers, who I think have the worst roster ever constructed in the NBA.
They might. It's up there.
And it's incredible. And, the Bobcats are still going to stay deal with Al. There's going to be a lot of wins in the East. A lot of wins to be had for the good teams because there are so few good teams and there's so many bad teams that, I can see those top four teams in the East all pushing 60 wins or top 50s. So I think they'll probably win 55 or 56 games. And then, I don't know what'll happen in the playoffs. I'm very fascinated to see. I hope, however it works out, those top four teams make it to the conference semis, and you can have some combination of Miami, Brooklyn, Chicago, and Indy playing those last two series in the East, because I think those would just be pretty awesome series all the way around.
Do the Nets? Here's a radio host question for you. Can you guarantee the Nets are in the Eastern Conference Finals?
No.
Okay.
Because I don't think you can. I don't think you can guarantee you can. I think if you're going to guarantee anybody, you can guarantee Miami. But I don't think you would guarantee that who their opponent is, right?
No.
And I could see a scenario where Miami loses in the second round to one of those teams. But obviously, the default pick is that Miami's going to get there. But yeah, those teams are all good. I mean, I think Rose should be really good, and that would mean Chicago is going to be really good, and really high in Indy. I think they're really good. And I think the Nets are really good. And, I certainly won't be surprised if they're in the conference finals. And I would be a little surprised if any of those four teams isn't in at least the semis,
right,
unless they have an injury.
Right.
But, yeah, I don't know. Those second round series are going to be absolutely phenomenal. And I don't know.
You are a little upset about some talk we had about Roy Hibbert versus Paul George on a previous podcast.
Upset? I don't even know if upset's the right word. I was just surprised. When you and Matt did the Pacers podcast, Matt just kind of said Roy Hibbert's definitely their best player, and you said and you just kind of agreed, and then you guys went on, and I was I did the really dumb thing where you look at your phone, like when you used to look at the radio,
right?
And I was like, really? I obviously think Lance Stephenson is their best player. To me, I think Paul George is the best player. I love Roy Hibbert. He's a great interview. I think he's a great player. The case I think for Paul George is, LeBron's clearly the best two-way player in the league, and especially on the wings. I don't think there's any, not only anybody's going to try to dispute that. I don't think there's a, I think the second best one is Paul George.
Oh, I don't know. Here's my problem with him is he's just not good attacking off the dribble.
I know you're a big guy attacking off the dribble, and obviously he struggled with splitting double teams.
Yeah.
And that stuff he has to work on, but it was his third year in the league, I think.
Yeah, that sounds right.
He was like 2 days before the season started, they basically said, all right, Paul, you're going to be our go-to guy offense because Danny's hurt. And his numbers went up across the board. He made the All-Star team, and which I know is an arbitrary thing. But he also, you know, during the Knicks series, I went to Pacers practice one day for a story, and we were talking to Frank Vogel, and you know, he made a pretty good point in that every single night, not only is he their go-to guy on offense, but they put him on the other team's best perimeter player every single game. And, you know, he wasn't denigrating LeBron or anybody else, but you know, a lot of times when you have when your go-to guy on offense is needing to score on a night, you're going to try to find a soft guy to put him on the other end.
Oh, yeah.
So he can get some rest and doesn't have to go crazy both ends because that's just smart. But the way the Pacers operate with their focus on defense, you know, they tell Paul George, all right, you're going to go lock down the best guy, and then we need you to score 20 points. And a lot of times he did that. And I think I know Roy wasn't as bad offensively as he was during the season when he had the wrist issue and whatever mental stuff was going on. But he also isn't the guy that was going 27-15 against Shane Battier and Joel Anthony in the conference finals. And I feel like because he was so good in that 7-game series, that you know, the recency of that is kind of taken over and it kind of ignored the fight. I think if you'd have said somebody 2 weeks before that, who's the Pacers' best player? I think the answer would have been Paul George for the vast majority of people. I'm wrong.
Here's my counter to that. I've got 2 points. Is that one, Paul George is a fantastic defender. I think it's a symbiotic relationship because I think he's able to defend that way because he knows he has Roy Hibbert behind him.
Right.
And so so it lets him unleash out. That's not to necessarily take away from anything he's doing. He's still a really good wing defender.
Totally fair.
But I think that helps. And then two, I think that people have been so desperate for another Tracy McGrady. Just like, I'm not talking about you here. I'm talking about just like the fan base in general. We've done it with like Gerald Green. We've done it with all kinds of like these lanky, mm-hmm. athletic wing players who can shoot or who look like they can shoot a little bit. And they're like, oh, this guy's going to be the next guy. This guy's going to be the next guy. And so I think like, well, I agree with you that the hype around Roy probably got a little too out of control because he dominated, you know, Chris Bosh in the post and Shane Battier in the post in the Eastern Conference Finals. I also think that the hype around Paul George has been like this expected jump to being one of the 10 best players in the league because he looks like the prototypical awesome small forward. And he's a great shooter. He's a great defender. He's great at cutting without the ball. But I just think that for me, it's just so hard to see him not be able to attack off the dribble and think like that guy's an offensive weapon that you can rely on every night. And it's unfair because he's been fantastic, but because of, I guess, their roles on the team, I value Roy Hibbert's role a little bit more than Paul George. Now, if you told me 5 months from now Paul George has far exceeded whatever Roy Hibbert can possibly give them, that wouldn't shock me. Like, if he came into the season being able to attack off the dribble and really, like, have a complete offensive game, I would buy it. It's just I don't think I've seen it yet. So that's my reservation with it.
I think that's fair. Now, he's gonna get 5 for 80 from the Pacers.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty clear.
Yeah.
That was never a consideration for Roy. Does that factor into your opinion at all?
No, I think that's a fair point. I think that I think Paul George is.
I know there's plenty of subcontext to that. I'm just curious what you think of that.
No, I think that's fair. I think it's what's weird is as as affable and as fun as Roy's personality is, Paul George is a lot easier to market. And yeah. So I think maybe that would factor into it a little bit, but I also, if Paul George is their next, or is their best player hands down over the next 5 years, I wouldn't be shocked. You know, if you had to ask me right now, if you had to ask me right now, who's better, I would say Roy Hibbert is better, slightly. I wouldn't say, I don't know that I agree with Matt's assertion that it's just hands down Roy Hibbert. I think there is absolutely an argument like we've had on here, but I would definitely pick Roy right now.
And to be clear, you know, I agree with you in that I think it's close. I'm not trying to say that.
Yeah.
Paul George twice as good. Now here's another Paul George question, because I've said this to other people. Who is a better player to you, Paul George or Carmelo?
To me, and I know this is not popular amongst the NBA blogosphere, it's Carmelo. Just for the simple fact, like I know that Paul George is just worlds better than him on defense. Like I recognize that. I don't deny that at any point. I think the way Carmelo affects a game is just greater than the way Paul George affects a game, because Carmelo takes so much attention. And whether he's choosing to pass with that attention coming towards him, or whether he's, you know, choosing to take pull-up jumpers against it, I think Carmelo affects the game in a way that Paul George cannot do yet.
I think Paul George is the better player, but I agree with you on Carmelo's impact on the game, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think Paul George is a more skilled player.
I think they're very close. Like I would have them probably both in my top 15 or 20 guys in the league.
Yeah.
And I think Paul George is slightly better because of how much better he is defensively. But to your point, you know, Carmelo, when Carmelo gets going, you can argue he's more impactful in the game than anybody in the league, maybe sometimes including LeBron, but probably up to LeBron and probably even with Durant.
Yeah.
And just when he gets going, he's just like a just unstoppable freight train.
Yeah.
Shot going.
And I think with me, and you know, you've seen this up close too, with Carmelo, I don't think people recognize, like, I don't know that it comes through on TV of just how physical he is and how much that wears down. It wears down the opposing defender and guys running at him to help and stuff. Like, he slams into people. Like, he's so physical. And I think that, you know, Paul George doesn't have that luxury. He's just not built in the same way. Now, he can affect the game in other ways. But I, like, to me, like, seeing that in person, I see that. And I'm like, you can see it taking a toll on someone throughout the course of a game. And I think that that's a little bit underrated. If you pick Paul George over Carmelo, I don't agree, but I understand it, just for the entire defensive side of it. Like, I get that. Me personally, like, I'll almost always go with the guy who makes who I view makes a bigger impact.
Well, it's funny you say that about Carmelo. This is a really weird comparison, but Carmelo to me is a lot like A-Rod in that.
Oh.
Not the way you think of going with this. When you see, the first time I was covering a Yankee game and I was up close to A-Rod, you don't really get how big A-Rod is.
Yeah.
On TV, and I don't mean in a steroid way. I just mean he's built like a tight end. He's like 6'5", 230. He's just a huge guy. And Carmelo plays kind of like that. Like, on TV, he looks like a small forward. You're like, okay. You know, he looks like a normal-sized NBA small forward. But, like you said, the way he throws his body around in the post, he plays like a guy who's, like, 6'10". And I agree. When you up close, seeing him really muscle guys around, it's why, you know, it is kind of what makes him such a unique player. And it's frankly why the Knicks were so good when he played the four last year, because he basically could play like a four but was as quick as a small forward.
Yeah.
And I'm curious to see now how, you know, with the addition of Barnes and, you know, the moves the Knicks made, how that changes that, because I think it'll take away some of his effectiveness if they take him away from that. But yeah, that's all. I'm very bullish on George. I saw a lot of the Pacers last year, and I covered a lot of them in the playoffs, and I just think he's a tremendous.
He's really good.
Two-way player.
Yeah, he's pretty incredible.
He's so good, and I mean, it's just one of many. I'm just overall really fired up for the season as a whole. I think there's just so many. You know, I mean, you guys have covered the tanking thing quite a bit, and now the free agency stuff with LeBron and Carmelo is starting. Not that that's enjoyable, but it's certainly interesting and important. And then, you know, there's so many different storylines for teams around the league between Rose and if the Pacers can come back the way they did, and how the Nets are going to look, and the Heat again, and the entire craziness in the West, and, you know, the fact that there's probably four or five teams that aren't going to make the playoffs in the West that would in the East. It's going to be a really, really interesting season.
Yeah, I'm excited for it. I'm excited for you to come to Minneapolis. I feel like we're going to play a little ball when you're here.
I hope so.
We're going to try to get that together. At worst, I feel like we go out for beers.
That would be at worst.
Well, yeah, which I feel like we're good at.
Steve kind of threatened my life on Twitter, so I'm not sure that I'll make it through the trip, but it'll be enjoyable.
Yeah, at least it's a good way to go, right?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what happened now that he. I'm trying to remember what happened that it came up, but I felt kind of like I was being threatened by Walter White.
Yeah.
I felt like it was that kind of moment.
He does have a little bit of a dark side on the court.
Yeah.
Which is surprising because he's such a nice guy.
I've heard he likes to face guard.
Yeah, he face guards if you get hot, so don't do that. And then he's like 5'10". He's a monster rebounder for a guy who's like 5'10" and doesn't jump. It's amazing. Like, it's impressive. Like, I'm not even trying to like be a jerk about that.
No,
like, he dominates the offensive boards. It's incredible.
Well, I'm not quite the guard you are, so I don't think I have to worry about getting face guarded.
You can just watch
Hopefully
me
we'll
run.
Find out.
You just watch me run 3-point line to 3-point line. That's all I like to do.
Well, hopefully we make it happen.
Definitely. Well, Tim, thank you so much. We can read your stuff on the New York Post. Follow you on Twitter @TimBonTemps. Always a pleasure, my friend.
Happy to do it, man.